Hello and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I am your host, Hugo Emerzal. If you enjoy our conversations and what we do here at Celebrating Cinema, you can support us by leaving a review on whichever podcast platform you're listening on and sharing our episodes with friends. It really helps other cinema lovers like yourself to find us. Hopefully, if you're listening, you joined us for our recent Celebrating Cinema film club screening of Terrence Malick's Night of Cups, a personal favorite of mine, featuring an introduction and Q&A with Tom van der Linden, the creator of the incredible YouTube channel Like Stories of Old. And for those unfamiliar, Like Stories of Old is a channel that explores the boundary between media analysis, philosophy, and personal development through emotionally resonant video essays. With millions of views and a devoted following, he has become a refreshing voice in cinema, encouraging audiences to perceive films through a fresh new lens. And Tom joins me today as we discuss the art of looking and our approaches to film criticism, as we both will be sharing why Terrence Malick's Night of Cups is an underrated masterpiece. So, hi, everybody. We're joined today by Tom van der Linden, whom you might know as the creator behind the incredible YouTube channel Like Stories of Old. And today we're diving into a film that is very meaningful to me. And Tom, I think it's also very meaningful to you, Night of Cups by Terrence Malick, the 2015 film. First of all, very welcome on Celebrating Cinema. We're very happy to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yes, our pleasure. And with all of our guests, Tom, we start with a somewhat profound question, but it gives us some insight in your personal background.
Okay.
Which is, if you could share a, like, let's say a formative early memory of like movie going or a cinema experience that you had that you were young that made a profound impact on you.
Oh, okay. I think I have one. When I was 6 years old, I think. Yeah, I think it was in mid-90s somewhere. My dad, he was really into cars and like old-timers, classic cars, and I wasn't at all. I was mostly into dinosaurs and stuff. And so one day he dragged me to what was going to be like this car show. And I was like kind of reluctantly going along because my mom made me. And so we were driving in the car, going to this car show. I was kind of like bummed out. But then it turned out, as a surprise, he was actually taking me to see the Jurassic Park, the second one, The Lost World.
Hell yeah.
Which was playing in theaters, which in hindsight may not have been the most responsible thing to do because that movie was like 12 years and up and I was 6 years old. But I still enjoyed it very much, and I couldn't follow along with like the subtitles at the time, so I just kind of was immersed into the visuals. But you know, Spielberg, especially the Jurassic Park movies, they have like a lot of very strong visual storytelling where even if you do not understand what the characters are saying, you can kind of follow along with the action. And so yeah, that was a really good movie-related memory for me that I'm not sure if it like sparked an actual, like a later interest in movies, but I still remember it from all those years ago. So I guess that says something.
That's so funny because when I was 6 years old, my parents gave me the VHS of Jurassic Park.
Oh, cool.
And I always thought that I wanted to be a paleontologist. But then in the end, I ended up becoming a film critic.
For me, that point happened when I found out that being a paleontologist or an archaeologist is mostly just brushing dust.
For me, it was at high school when I found out that I had to be good at like natural sciences and biology and that kind of stuff. And I hated that. Well, okay, so we already have a lot in common here, and we're going to talk about a film that we both love, but we're going to also do it from our respective positions, you know, as film critics, and you, of course, as a video essayist, you work in a very specific manner. And I just wanted to ask first, what was the kind of maybe push that you had really to take this film criticism and film analysis more seriously? How did you get into it? What motivated you to really make that maybe a life, career, or path?
I don't remember exactly where that started. I remember it started out relatively late. Like I had a casual interest in movies for most of my teenage years, I think. And then when I went to college or university, that's really when I had a lot of free time. And that's when I kind of like started getting into more classic cinema, more art house cinema. And that's really when this interest started, or a more serious interest. And I was studying something else. I was doing spatial planning at the time. Ended up doing a master's in environmental sociology, so not movie related at all. But I liked the idea of what I learned there is that you have like an issue or a subject or a problem, and you go at it from a variety of different angles. That's basically sociology in a nutshell. And I like doing that to movies, and which also helped me because movies, in a lot of the time, they were these very practical examples of more abstract ideas that mm-hmm. that for me helped clarify a lot of stuff.
Oh, yes.
That's basically how movies became a tool for me just personally. And once I got more seriously interested, I also realized like, oh shit, I'm not going to film school. So I have to make an active effort to watch a lot of movies. So I would kind of go to other filmmakers, you know, the famous ones who've what they said in interviews or advice they gave, like, oh, you should watch. I remember like Richard Linklater at one point saying like, oh, you gotta at least know your like Ingmar Bergman. And I just like the Wild Strawberries and the other famous one, but like the deep catalog too. So the next weeks I would just watch all of Ingmar Bergman's movies. And it's only like years later that I realized that even people in film school, they didn't watch as many movies as I did during those years. So I kind of overshot my target maybe a little bit, but.
But hey, I mean, it resulted in you having a YouTube channel where you publish your video essays that is very popular because, you know, you have very rigorous work on there and it's very interesting. And I think you do it from a place of great generosity as well, the insights that you share in it. Before we dive really into, I would say, Malik, I wanted to ask you as well, what kind of the strategies were or kind of like the philosophy that you have when you approach your work as a video essayist, kind of like, what is the mission that you have when you are making these videos and share them with your audience?
I think I initially started out, or my interest in video essays specifically started with the idea that you can talk about cinema while using the means of cinema or using cinema itself even. I like the idea of having the ability to employ like music and just editing, audiovisual editing, to kind of invoke more of the emotional weight of what you also want to talk about in these movies. Like I kind of started with this place like, okay, movies have moved me in a certain way. They've shaped me in a certain way. And I want to convey some of that weight in the way that I communicate about that. And that's really what brought me to the video essay format. It was also just an easy tool because I could make video essays on my own without relying on like traditional means of filmmaking. Like I didn't have to have a camera. I just needed the microphone, at least in the beginning. Because, you know, I, like many others, I initially figured like, oh, maybe I'll make traditional documentaries or something like that. But that quickly transitioned into video essays once I realized the barrier for entry is so much lower. And I just also looked at some other video essayists and I thought like, okay, a lot of these are kind of film school people, it looked like Lesson from the Screenplay was a screenwriter, I think, or an aspiring screenwriter / filmmaker. Every Frame of Painting was a professional editor. And I figured, so, oh, maybe I can go at it from that more thematic, philosophical angle and talk more about the meanings within movies. And yeah, that's how I kind of started doing that. Even when I'm critical, I want to be, for me, it was more about being constructive and creating understandings about how movies work and about how ideas work, rather than just saying, oh, this is good, this is bad, this is why you should feel so-and-so about a movie, this is why you should feel bad about a movie. Like for me, it was more about giving insights rather than doing like a typical review where I kind of judge it in more good or bad terms. You know, I do that, but I feel like I try to at least always construct it or add as many constructive elements to it that it makes, that it still feels reasonable. Like I wouldn't say anything in my videos that I wouldn't say to the filmmaker's face,
exactly.
Even if I'm being more critical about it. Like I feel like if you can supported with arguments, then, you know, I at least I hope like a filmmaker wouldn't be offended.
This is very relatable to me in the publication that I write for. And I've had a couple of occasions where a filmmaker was offended.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have to have those conversations, which are actually very interesting and thankful. I always am very happy when they happen, because then at least you have this dialogue, which can be very exciting and a bit scary, mm-hmm. but at least something is happening. Well, you mentioned the philosophical aspect, right? And I think that's probably the perfect segue to talk about Terrence Malick and end up with Knight of Cups. But before we start there, I think it's good to kind of acknowledge who this Terrence Malick is, a filmmaker that almost 51 years ago to this date premiered Badlands, a beautiful film about an older guy falling in love with a younger girl, kind of like a James Dean kind of character. It's a boy meets cute, but it's also a very dangerous story because they kill some people, go on the run, and you kind of join them along in this, like, the American landscape, in the Badlands, the heartlands of America. And that set off this legendary career of, I would say, very legendary filmmaker as well, because in the next 50 years, he was a somewhat enigmatic figure that could, for the longest time, not make a film and then suddenly reemerge with classic after classic. Days of Heaven, of course, one of the most strikingly beautifully shot films with this stunning score by Ennio Morricone. The Thin Red Line, an incredible anti-war film. The New World, one of my favorite films of all time, the Pocahontas story and the settling of Jamestown in America. And then slowly we work our way throughout these past decades to a somewhat controversial run of movies that follows one of his magnum opuses, The Tree of Life, which just made a huge impact at the Cannes Film Festival when it premiered. The Tree of Life was the first film where it combined a contemporary setting with still scenes that took place in a imagined past, very much modeled after Terrence Malick's own childhood in the 1950s, but had scenes that were playing in the present with John Penn just idling around the skyscraper offices in this kind of like faceless city, just filled with this existential ennui of a person completely stuck in time and in his own life and in his own mind. And then after that, there was a whole run of films that were not as celebrated as the masterpieces that came before. It started with To the Wonder, a Ben Affleck starring film. Then we had Knight of Cups, the film that we will talk about a lot today. And it ended this run with Son to Son, a film that takes place behind the music industry of the present around South by Southwest and a couple of other things. A lot of people didn't really like those films, Tom. So it's very nice that you are here.
I know.
defend these films a little bit with me, because I'm also one of those crazy people that actually loves the contemporary Malicks, probably maybe the most. So maybe to sum up this entire kind of like little background thing, I wanted to ask you, what can you say about Knight of Cups as a film, but also what was it initially that made you so interested in specifically these films of Terrence Malick as well?
Yeah, I think the reason I wanted to talk about them today is because they are less appreciated than the other ones. Like, we could have talked about The Tree of Life, but I feel like that one is already so celebrated as in what it does and what it is, whereas the newer ones, they still feel kind of neglected also critically and by general audiences. But yeah, I liked the way Malick just seemed to completely free himself from all sort of filmmaking dogmas or constraints that he might have imposed on himself earlier on, and really use cinema not as a way, as a sort of pre-mediated tool, but rather as a way to search for something that he doesn't know what it's going to be at the beginning. Because I feel like, if I remember correctly, like those, especially his newer films, they take a lot more time in the editing room. They are very much like constructed in post-production instead of in the pre-production, where, you know, you might write the script, you might, you know, if you look at a Nolan, you know, I think Nolan pretty much has a film wrapped up in the script.
Exactly. Storyboarded to a T, every part is already kind of figured out.
Yeah. Not that to say that one's better than the other, but, you know, most movie makers or filmmakers, they do it that way. They And you have to, like, you have to, filmmaking is a very restrictive endeavor where you are, you know, you have time constraints, you have scheduling constraints, you have financial constraints. And for some reason, which has always still baffled me a little bit, Malik seems to have none of those. Like, he can he can get all these A-list stars and then shoot whatever, whenever, and then let his movie sit for 5 years in the editing room while he's kind of tinkering with it. I remember, like, this anecdote from Christian Bale, who said he shot, like, a few scenes for Song to Song, which he ended up not being in. But he said, like, yeah, I only shot for, like, a few days, so I figured I'm probably not going to be in it. Which is also this thing that Malik is a little bit notorious for, that he,
oh, yes,
he can, you know, not always communicate, or especially early on in The Thin Red Line, there's this famous story.
Adrian Brody.
Exactly.
The poor guy.
He thought he was going to be the main character, and then he ended up being, like, almost like an extra in a few scenes at the end of the movie.
Yeah, how shocked he must have been when he was at the premiere of the film and figured out, wait, this film is not about me.
I think he has a point there. Like, I don't mind, like, I think Malik is in his right to kind of put the movie first before the needs of the actors, but at least have that communication clear beforehand. Like, I think later on, like, with Christian Bale, that example that I mentioned, like, he knew what he was in for. Like, he's going to shoot a few days, he's going to have some fun or play around, explore some stuff, and then maybe he'll end up being in the movie, maybe not at all. You know, as long as you know what you're getting into, I think that's fine. But yeah, the communication aspect of that is important, I'd say. Yeah,
we'll discuss this relationship with the actors a bit more later, because there's some other fascinating stuff there. But I think before we dive in a little bit deeper about these, like, strategies of filmmaking for Terrence Malick, it's good to try to explain to our listeners what Night of Cups and these modern films are even about.
Yeah,
if I can take one crack at it, it is Christian Bale is starring in the film. In this one, he is actually in the film, but he is the protagonist, of course. He's a screenwriter who's drifting around LA. Also, just like Sean Penn's character in The Tree of Life, seems to be kind of like stuck in a version of time and space and within his own soul and mind, maybe. There are some things that are very clearly in his life unresolved, and they have to do with his father. They have to do with his brother. They kind of, like, come in and out of the film, and the film itself is constructed around these tarot cards that suggest maybe possible life paths, but also reflect on the life decisions that he has chosen. I would say that it is, again, a film about, like, contemporary ennui and maybe about an existential crisis and about depression, even, because if there's one thing that the film very strongly conveys is that this interiority of Christian Bale's character is just completely fucked. He's just a completely sad, melancholic figure that's just wandering and drifting around aimlessly while there's parties happening and people chattering, and people drift in and out of his life, lovers, lost friends, people from the movie industry, but none of it really seems to hit him in his core. Do you think that's a fair description of what the film is?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much correct, insofar that there is a correct interpretation. I would also point out that there's this fable that's alluded to at the beginning, which is about, you know, there's this narrator who explains this story about an old prince, I think it was, like, from some rich country who goes west into Egypt, which in this case might be, like, west into Hollywood.
Yeah.
Where the people, like, they pour him a cup, like a magical potion, and he falls into a sleep.
Yeah.
And, you know, the king back in the old country, he's worried. He'll send, like, messengers, and, you know, he'll get, like, moments of awareness back out of the prince, but he will fall asleep again. And I feel like that's a struggle that's very much present in this movie, and also in many of Malick's other movies, where you have this conflict between a sort of awareness about maybe our, you know, about ourselves, about our existential situation, about our desire for meaning. And then on the other hand, there's the world and, you know, even some, like, internal mechanisms that make us kind of, that kind of dull that sense and that kind of make us forget, make us fall asleep, make us fall back into these automated processes of distractions, that sort of stuff, which end up not fulfilling us. And so there's this kind of struggle, like, how can we keep that awareness alive, and how can we maintain like a conscious mode of living, a conscious like search for meaning. And yeah, that I think that's something that's also very much present in the Tree of Life. And but I think it's most explicit here in Knight of Cups.
Yeah, that's a beautiful addition. And, you know, I think it's good to acknowledge, I already tried to make that connection with philosophy and Terrence Malick, that a lot of people position Terrence Malick as the great film philosopher. Hmm. He has a philosophy background from a university. It's known that he has translated works of Martin Heidegger from German into English. So people often kind of like apply these kind of Heideggerian philosophical kind of like theories or constructs on his cinema and the way that it reflects on maybe the human experience.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that many of his films, past films, go in these like deep historic eras, often really showing something foundational or something very, let's say, influential or formative of maybe the American experience or the modern world, how it was shaped by previous eras. And now we find ourselves in the midst of the 21st century in this kind of like whirlpool, this flux of impulses of like this digital connected world that seemingly also completely disembodies us.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you also find this connection, like how you see that connection, or if that's a thing that you apply to specifically these films as well, because it's very easy to make it. But is that also the approach that you have when you go and watch a Terrence Malick film, that you see it as a kind of cinematic reflection filtered through philosophy or something?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, knowing how well versed Malick is in philosophy, it's impossible, I think, to separate the two, even if I don't think he explicitly set out to make like a philosophical treatise on something. He just wants to tell like, or reflect on something about some aspect of the human condition. It's just impossible, yeah, to separate those two and not view them through those lenses, which I think would even be a shame, because I think they add so much richness and understanding also to the way he's playing, not just with the content of the movie, but also with the form of it,
yeah.
The presentation, and just the basic language of movie is transformed because of the way he sort of philosophizes about things. Like one thing I'll say about Heidegger, which I'm by no means an expert on, but you know, I have a very simplistic understanding of it, which is that at least one part of his philosophy, or at least one part of his philosophy that I think also applies to the way Malick's characters in his movies operate, is that there's basically this argument that human beings basically have this a sort of tool-based view of life, meaning that we, you know, when we pick up a hammer, we initially just see like, what can we use this for? And so maybe in the world at large, we also tend to see things as, there's stuff to consume. How can we consume this? Like, how, there's stuff to build. How do we build this? Or there's a car. Where can I drive this to? And in that analogy, like the way he then explains sort of the human condition is that when we don't think about how things work until they kind of break. So you don't think about the being of the hammer, so to say, until the hammer mm-hmm. somehow breaks or stops fulfilling the function that we envisioned for it. And so that's one aspect about Knight of Cups that I also find interesting, is where you can kind of see this, and a lot of Malick's characters, they kind of start out being a soldier in the thin red line, a farmer in a hidden life, or just some character in some world functioning as that world is made or envisioned to function. And then something breaks, you know, there's something that sort of breaks that connection, and where we suddenly become aware of the meaning of that thing. And that's kind of when the story starts. You know, there's in the Thin Red Line, very early on, there's this break with, you're kind of introduced to the war, not through warfare, but actually in that state of harmony with the indigenous peoples on those yeah. islands. And
then the warship comes with the Americans yeah, yeah. on it, and that's when trouble really starts again. Yes.
Yeah. And in Knight of Cups, for example, there's this early on, I think in one of the first scenes, there's this earthquake.
Yes.
That kind of, that's a like a literal wake-up call for yeah. the character. And then you'll see him doze off again, and then there will be something that kind of snaps him into awareness again, and then you have this continuous cycle between kind of just mindlessly falling into kind of functional behavior, and then having these moments where you kind of are sort of elevated above it to kind of reflect on what it all means and kind of touching the void that's beneath the whole thing.
It's such a good point, because I think all of his films are about this ruptured harmony that like, and there's often this kind of like Garden of Eden almost analogy that you can make, that for a brief moment, people are capable of making their own version of heaven on earth. Either it's by falling in love, for instance, in Badlands, where that happens. To some degree, it's happening in Days of Heaven when the lover's on the run. They kind of like set up this plan and it seems to work out. It's this kind of scheme. And when it seems to be working, they are very happy. But then obviously at some point it breaks. It's beautifully done in The New World, where when Captain Smith and Pocahontas fall in love, just the entire universe seems to coalesce around this love. But then when the reality of like the things that you just said as well, just when danger basically arrives or sin or whatever, something breaks it either from within or from externally. And then once it's broken, it's almost impossible to put together again, which is very tragic. But then for me, Knight of Cups is just such an interesting film because it never seems to be whole to begin with, right? What does he have that suggests this harmony? Maybe nothing. Whereas in To the Wonder, the film he made before, it is a film about love. It is a melodrama. There's multiple love triangles interpolated within it. And for brief moments in the film, again, there is this kind of like paradise, Garden of Eden thing established. And it breaks. But there's nothing here to break, which is for me very exciting, because then how does Malick deal with that? What is then the tension or the central conflict of the film, right? It's an interesting proposition. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, there are some glimpses of like when the main character had like a genuine relationship. And there's some moments there where he, you know, he keeps falling into these different relationships with different women. And, you know, there's one of them that points out to him, you're not looking for love. You're just looking for the idea of love. And I think there's some truth in there as to like his sort of pathological situation where he just keeps, he's just kind of stuck in the same cycle. I think with each of those, or at least with some of those women, there are genuine glimpses into what could have been. Like, he is reaching for something, and it's sort of like with some of these people, it you can kind of see it on the horizon, even though he doesn't quite get there fully. There's also, you know, some memories from farther back, like when he was a child, and I think maybe that's what something like for him, like kind of like in the, as in the Tree of Life, there is the sense of harmony is something that was did this thing at the very beginning, and that's just
a very fragile harmony as well, because his relationship with his dad is obviously very dysfunctional, as the film suggests.
You have like a lot of these voiceovers, and at one point I think he says something along the lines of like he spent years like not even knowing who he was or what not remembering the kind of man he wanted to be. So I feel like if there was genuine harmony in his life, it is it's been lost long ago. And which, I guess that's the main tension of this movie. Like there's not that clear distinction between, oh, this is where I have to be, or this is where I used to be, and that's where I have to return to or get to somehow. It's which in some ways makes it more interesting, because it feels a little bit more true to life, where we, you know, I don't think a lot of people have this clear moment of perfect harmony in their lives or in their pasts, or at least not as clearly as, you know, those love scenes in The New World, for example, where it's clear like, oh yeah, this was the absolute peak of the lives of those characters, or at least of John Smith. In that sense, it relates more to the modern condition, I think, where people have spent, you know, some people will spend years like kind of in that mode of searching, kind of every now and then kind of slipping or getting that awareness again, like, oh, wait, I am someone, I have to do something, or I want some fulfillment, some meaning in my life, and then kind of forgetting it again in just the day-to-day existence and just kind of dragging on. And
It's this idea of non-linearity, where it's like, even if you feel like you're going forward, maybe at the same time you're also going backwards. You're just kind of completely lost in this stream of, directionlessness, this drifting in the wind. And I think the film does a great job of embodying that in its visual style and this kind of like strategy of editing it. You already mentioned that Malik, as of late, has been this crazy tinkerer who is just, you know, plucking away in the editing suite. There's this interesting story now about his upcoming film, The Way of the Wind, which is kind of like his Jesus story, where he's working with a group of multiple film editors, which is what he often does. But they are doing like insane editing sessions, like hours and hours on end, all the way through the night, with the goal of basically breaking down editing conventions that these editors have been trained to have, like in their day-to-day work or at film school or with other more conventional films, so that they can get into a state of pure associative editing where they release all rules, all norms, all conventions, and just try to completely vibe on the imagery and on the flow of the movie. I think Night of Cups already shows that very well, but also does it by combining these different visual elements. It's, you know, this Emmanuel Lubezki shot film with a lot of this insane digital cinematography. There's these like short GoPro clips in it, another like digital ephemeral imagery that also enhances the textural quality of the film. What do you make of this like very distinct visual style for Malik, which is crummy, it's more janky, but at the same time, it's so completely captivating for me. I'm completely obsessed with it.
Yeah, I love it very much. I think in general, like, I think cinema can be like the best, like the most accurate sort of mimetic response to human consciousness, in the sense that you can capture through film how we see or experience the world sort of internally, where we always have like we see the present moment in front of us, but it's always sort of interspersed with memories, with imaginations, with kind of the weight of our, you know, past being that we bring into the present, and our kind of hopes, dreams, fears, and ambitions for the future that we also, that are also kind of lurking behind that. And I think I want to also credit like Tarkovsky here. I think Malik would probably do the same, who I think was one of the first to really try this with The Mirror, which is also kind of, I guess that would be Tarkovsky's The Tree of Life, a very personal journey, like a very elusive journey into the into his own past, which doesn't make much sense on first sight if you're coming at it from an outsider who doesn't know at all who he is. But anyways, just to point out, like, Malik was not the first to do this. There's other filmmakers that have done this before, but I think Malik has definitely been sort of pioneering a new, the sort of new age version of that, if that's a good way to say it, which has clearly like influenced a lot of other filmmakers. Like, I don't think people often appreciate just how much I think a lot of the visual language in other movies, even like something like Inception, I think there Nolan even talked about Malik being a very strong inspiration on the way he edits. But just that idea that you can just, let's say you have like a shot of a character and then you have like a blink of a second, like memory interspersed there like that, that I think was very, feels very Malik-y. Or like a very clear thing that has been, that he has been working on for a long time as like just new, sort of new cinematic language, where you always have this, you know, the past, present, and future is always like sort of in the same realm of existence, always happening or occurring simultaneously. And I think especially with the later movies, The Night of Cups, The Two to Wonder, there's even more of this deliberate disconnect from the present moment, where he will like, you'll have characters having a conversation in one location and then the conversation continues, but there's somewhere else and then they're in this location again. Like it feels like he's like, he probably is, but I'm not sure. It feels like he's sort of deliberately breaking continuity and just deliberately taking us out of the specifics of the scene to kind of be connected only with the conversation that's happening, the train of thought that's going on, or the reflection that's going on, or just the visuals or the mood of it that's sort of palpable in the background, and just connect to that more emotional layers and kind of let go of that more, the logical stuff or the more specific stuff that's right there in the foreground, which I think he does very effectively in these newer movies, where you kind of fully embrace this and you kind of know, you understand this as the audience, like, oh, it's not about where they are standing at this very moment, like it's, or what's being said or what's being done. It's kind of about what's being felt at the time by the characters in some way, about what the mood is. And that's, it's just a very more like an emotional engagement than just a, I don't want to say intellectual one, but, you know, other than the more traditional type of movie making where you're more invested in the plot, in the story, in the sort of surface level mechanics of it all.
This is such a good point because, you know, I alluded to his like philosophical background, but I think a thing that is very underappreciated with Malick in general is the emotional groundedness and maybe emotional realism of his work. And A friend of mine is a film critic. His name is John Bleasdale. He has an upcoming book on Terrence Malick, which will be published in December. It's a biography of Terrence Malick.
Oh, cool.
Very deep research. I can definitely recommend it to everybody once it gets released. We'll include a link in the show notes of this episode. But in this book, his main goal was actually to show how much the personal biography of Malick has informed his films and to actually drag him away from the world of philosophy a bit more towards a grounded personal maybe urgency that he always puts in the material. For instance, in To the Wonder, it's very much a film apparently that's alluded to the first marriage that Malick had with his first wife who passed away.
Yeah.
And one of the characters in the film is modeled after her, which is a thing that you don't know. And then you just think, who are these people in this kind of philosophical construct? But actually there's much more there than just the philosophical, let's say, setup. And I think you feel that very palpably in Knight of Cups as well, a film that, yes, it is a reflection on all of these things that we mentioned before, but it's also a very grounded emotional story. And I don't know, this seems to be such an underrated part. And I wanted to ask you about this as well. Like, the critiques of this film have been, for me, quite perplexing often. I remember when I wrote a review of this film in my magazine, Film Cunt, I gave the film 4.5 stars. Mm-hmm. And my editor-in-chief back in the day, a great writer, by the way, Dana Linse, she's also one of the chief film critics of NRC, a Dutch newspaper. And in NRC, she gave the film 1 star.
Oh, no.
So we had this interesting conversation, this contrasting views where she called it like a vapid perfume commercial playing out over the course of 2 hours.
Yeah. It's a common critique, like the perfume commercial. That's one you'll often hear. Yeah.
And I was going on about this, like, oh, this reflection on time and emotions and this and that.
Yeah.
So what do we make of the haters, basically? What can we say to the haters that they have been missing out on? And how can we reinforce our audience that wants to go see the film in Lab 111 as well, that in fact, this might be more than just a perfume commercial?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a tough one. I think some of those things just simply take time. There's a lot of movies from like 10 years ago that are being reappreciated now just because at the time people didn't connect with the language of it, even though, you know, over time and with more exposure, people become more accustomed to it. I think in general, it feels like we tend to pretend a little bit too much that we've reached like the end point of what film is and how we relate to it, not fully like sort of understanding that this is an art form that hasn't been around for like more than 150 years. Like, it's still so young comparatively to like literature or paintings. And so I think there's so much more still that can be done with the language of it and also with our understanding of it. And so, yeah, just how to make that turn around the haters in this moment, I'm not 100% sure. I think the more important thing, I think, is to sort of embrace that this is not a movie, as I mentioned earlier, like this is not like a pre-mediated, constructed thing. Like, the movie in itself, I think, is a sort of search for something. And I think if you're willing to embrace that, like just go along with the flow of it, go along with the emotion of it, then you'll have a much better time than when you're just kind of sitting there wondering, like, when's the plot going to kick in? Or what's this? Why isn't this character more worked out? Or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And earlier during the episode, we were talking about his relationship with actors, right? The Christian Bale story, the Adrian Brody story. But a thing that I found through this John Bleasdale, with whom I had many conversations about Malick, because he, you know, he spent time with the man, a lot of time, actually. He learned a lot about him and with a lot of people that was close collaborators. And so what he said is that many filmmakers or many actors that are interested in filmmaking themselves wanted to be on set with Malick to see how he does it. Because like you acknowledged as well, he is in a strangely unique position where he can make films exactly in the way that he wants to make them. And he can organize his sets in a specific way. He can organize his shoots in a specific way. He can write his film scripts in a specific way, and he can edit them exactly how he wants. So for instance, Natalie Portman, who has, you know, segued a little bit into directing as well with Jane Got a Gun, which was not a very successful film, but still an interesting film nonetheless. She was very interested and keen on working with Malick to learn things from him about his approaches to directing, because it is a non-conventional approach, because it puts the process of making the film before everything else, basically. And it's an intuitive process that's very close to the person that is making it. It's a personal expression. So apparently they have this genuine connection that goes very, very deep. And they call on a weekly basis because he stays in touch with a lot of these people. These kind of things. And that also completely changed my perspective on why he makes the films that he, in the way that he wants to make him. Because he needs to have that control, and people are fascinated by that sense of control as well, even if it means that they have to give up a lot of control themselves because they're at the mercy, basically, of his insane vision of how a film should be made.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is also why, to come back to the criticism part, these films, they get a lot of resistance, is because they are an alternative mode of filmmaking, and it presents an alternative of how you can construct these stories. And then maybe for some people the alternative is not strong enough or something. I don't know. But it's interesting to think about how he really shows how filmmaking can also be done.
Yeah. I think there's something liberating about it too. Like, I'm not a filmmaker, but like in my mind I've like imagined stuff. And I felt like a lot of movies, like if you look at The Godfather or Kubrick, you know, someone who, or Coppola or Kubrick, you know, these are movies that are very, they almost like, they are very inspiring to watch as an audience, but as a filmmaker, I can imagine they might be a little bit demotivating because they set such a high bar with these very deliberate shots or these intricate setups. And then you're like, oh, I could never do that. But then if you look at something like Knight of Cups, there's a sort of, it kind of frees you from all that baggage of what came before. Like, it opens your perception to like, oh, maybe I can just, even if I just have like the GoPro and my digital camera, I can take all these like random shots or perfume commercial shots and kind of weave them into something that is still meaningful, that still tells a story or conveys an emotion. And I always, like, for me in that sense, Malick has been the most inspirational one from like a filmmaker point of view, because I just feel like the freedom he assumes in his, in kind of exploring how he constructs a movie, that to me has been, just something about it that feels very close to something that I think I could do, even though, you know, there's obviously more going on behind the scenes there than it looks at first glance. But yeah, I don't know. There's just something, as I said, liberating about it that I just find very inspirational.
I remember one of the actors in Knight of Cups in one of the party scenes, because there's a lot of lavish party scenes because it's Hollywood, of course, that he described what the vibe was on the set, and that Malick would just slip notes into people's hands or pockets and they would have very enigmatic messages, and that would be the director's kind of like guidance, like, just think about this.
Yeah.
And so actors are completely perplexed. I've also heard stories of like him taking a cut on a take, going to the actor, whispering something in their ear for minutes on end, and then just the actor breaking down crying from something that he was saying, And then after the cry, just, okay, let's do it again and then shoot stuff. Just this the kind of like, yeah, like you say, liberatory way of, on an emotional level, also making film, and on the spiritual level, maybe. It's completely fascinating to me. I never consider myself a filmmaker. I don't want to make films, but it would be so interesting to be, to perceive this energy on set. If I could, I would give everything basically to spend one day on a Terrence Malick set and see what it feels like. For sure.
Same, yeah. Yeah, I can imagine there's some actors who don't like that, or I know some actors who are like, give me the script and I'll read the lines, but I'm not doing any improvisational stuff. I guess if you are more open to that sort of freeing experience, then it can be very fun. I can imagine as an actor where you're just kind of being freed to do whatever. Like Christian Bale at one point said in Night of Cups, like, you would just drive around with the GoPro, and if they felt like doing a scene, they would do a scene, and Malick wasn't even there, or they were just kind of doing, collecting stuff, and then he would be called into this van, and then Terrence Malick had written like a few lines of voiceover that he would narrate. So yeah, I can imagine it's a very unique experience, very unlike any other. That can be either like the ultimate nightmare for an actor, or the sort of ultimate dream.
Well, that sounds like perspective in general on the late Maliks. Either you fucking hate it or you completely love it and adore it somewhere in those 1-star, 5-star movies. Tom, before we head off, is there any final thing that you want to add, or something that our listeners should take away from this as well if they're getting ready into late Malick, or do you feel like we covered everything well enough?
It's interesting to talk about a little bit about the story progression of Night of Cups, because it doesn't have, like, even compared to Malick's previous movies, there is, you know, The New World had a clear story, The Thin Red Line had a clear story or story arc where it begins at one point, there's conflict that happens, there's resolutions, there's an ending. But Night of Cups is kind of, it almost feels like it ends at the same place where it starts at some point, or in some way. And that's something that has always fascinated me about this movie in particular. It doesn't feel like it goes somewhere in particular at the end. Like there's just...
Exactly.
It's just more of a reflection of these waves of awareness and distraction.
I mean, it literally ends in the desert. So it's we're still kind of adrift. We still don't really know where we end up.
Yeah. And it ends with like the word begin in the voiceover. So it feels like this whole movie is in some way prelude to the actual story that might be happening after this. Or maybe this movie is the reflection of how everything else will be.
Or how it could loop possibly back into itself.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's this line in the script from The Tree of Life that isn't as made as explicit in the movie, I think, but there's... In The Tree of Life, you also have this moment where you have that the Brad Pitt character, the kind of authoritarian father who at one point has this sort of revelation also when he's fired from his job. And, you know, he says like, I want to be a big man, but I'm nothing. And he's kind of witnessing the glory around him and kind of having this renewed appreciation in the same way that the character in Night of Cups also has these moments of awareness. But then in the script, which you can read online, even though I think Malick wasn't a fan of the fact that it leaked. But then in the script, there's this question at the end of that where it kind of wonders, like, will he hold on to this revelation or will he let it slip away again? And that's, I think it also circles back at the end where with the Sean Penn character, like, will this revelation be, will this lead into a genuinely new sort of life attitude or whatever? A second new start, or will it just be forgotten again? And I think that's something that Night of Cups makes maybe even more explicit by having, as you said, also maybe a strong hint that it might just be a circle that's kind of looping around where it's not actually about reaching that moment of awareness. It's just about understanding that process of how we come into awareness and then slip out of it again and come into it again and slip out of it again. And maybe finding some meaning or some progress in the understanding of that whole predicament
It sounds very comforting as well, even though it's a film that shows how hard it is to reach a destination, especially if you don't know what the destination is. It feels like the film is very caring and comforting towards that predicament as well. Like, yes, yeah. This is what it means to be a human as well, to not know.
Yeah.
And maybe there's strength and comfort there as well. And that's maybe also beautiful and fine, as long as it grounds you somewhat from within or something, which is a very new agey thing to say, but yeah, that's where you get, like, you get into the sentimental new agey mode quite easily with Malick, but in a way for me that actually reinforces life beliefs instead of just ticking off the cliches of what we assume new age is.
Yeah, because it doesn't have that definitive resolution. And I think even in the, you mentioned the tarot cards earlier, which I always felt like as another sign that this movie is sort of retroactively trying to find meaning instead of from the the beginning out.
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, we have this, you know, we have maybe like 100 hours, maybe more of like footage. How do we, what's the story here? Which I think is very much that a reflection of how we in our own lives do it. Like we have all these memories, we have all these feelings, these aspirations. Like how do we find some kind of red line here or some through line? And then I think that that's what Knight of Cups so beautifully displays, like the kind of the sort of handholds that we grab to or grasp for to kind of organize that whole sort of perceptive chaos into something coherent, something stable, like something give it some order in, you know, by any means necessary, almost, whether it's that kind of new agey stuff that's I think also explicitly in the movie. The tarot cards, the religious stuff, you know, at the end there's also a priest that comes up. And that's just, yeah, in that sense, it's not a didactic movie. It's not telling you how to live. It's more of this kind of reflection of the human condition in that sense, which is, yeah, what I really admire about it and why I think it's just so underappreciated.
And why people should come and see it in Lab 111, because that's obviously the reason that we're brought together today to have such a lovely chat. So Tom, you know, thank you so much for nerding out with me on Knight of Cups. It's very
special
when two like-minded souls come together and have a film like this to talk about. Obviously, aside from your YouTube channel, like Stories of Old, that we can direct our listeners to, is there anything else you want to plug or want to share, something that you're working on or something that you like more eyeballs on?
No, I think that's it. Anything I'll make in the future that will go through the, it will go through the channel anyway. So yeah, if you follow like Stories of Old on YouTube or on Nebula also, then you're not going to miss out.
Okay, perfect. Of course, we're very excited to have you in Lab 111 for the screening of this film as well. And I hope that we'll, you know, convert a lot of non-believers into the church of Terrence Malick and his late works.
Looking forward to it. Yeah, same.
So Tom van der Linde, thank you so much for being with us today. And we'll see you soon in Lab 111.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to stay up to date with everything we're doing here on Celebrating Cinema and at Lab, you can follow us at Lab111 on both Instagram and now also Letterboxd. And make sure to check out Tom's collection of incredible video essays via his YouTube channel, like Stories of Old. You certainly won't be disappointed. Listen back to our latest discussion all about female stereotypes we love in cinema, and our most recent interview with director Tarsem Singh celebrating the fall's return to cinema. And if you enjoy what we do, please support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform and sharing our episodes with your friends. It really helps other cinema lovers discover us too. You can find all the films, books, everything else mentioned, plus bonus info and link to tickets in our show note as always. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom. Music from myself, Hugo Emerzau, and artwork from Studio FFF.